This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. Today, I'm delighted to have in the studio with me Amitabh Pal, the managing editor at The Progressive Magazine, my colleague for a dozen years now, and he's the author, I'm pleased to say, of an important and impressive new book, Islam Means Peace, Understanding the Muslim Principle of Nonviolence Today. Amitabh Pal, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Thanks so much, Matt.
Why don't you tell me and tell the listener what prompted you to write the book in the first place?
Well, I've had an interest in nonviolence and pacifism ever since I was a child, and I came to know of Gandhi back in India, came to know of Martin Luther King a bit later on. Written extensively on the subject back in 2001, 2002, immediately in the aftermath of the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan. And given the image that Pashtuns had in this country, I remembered as a young man hearing about Bacha Khan, Khan Abdul Ghaffar Khan, this nonviolent leader, incredible figure, an associate and friend of Gandhi's. And I wrote about him for The Progressive. And from there on, basically, the book evolved. Prager commissioned me to write a book on Islam and nonviolence.
I'd never heard of this guy before. Before you wrote about him for The Progressive, tell us about Ghaffar Khan and why his story is so instructive.
Incredible person. Sprang from the same soil as the Taliban. Was born and raised in the frontier region of Pakistan, a region unfortunately associated today with violence and terrorism. Yet he turned toward nonviolence very early on in life, not under the influence of Gandhi, as many Indians especially like to believe, but on his own, under the inspiration of Islam. Again and again, he emphasized that his creed of nonviolence was directly inspired by the Prophet Muhammad and by the Quran. Founded an organization called Servants of God, the Khudai Khidmatgar, which at its peak had 100,000 members, Pashtuns dedicated to nonviolence, social reform, religious tolerance, gender equality. You can't make this stuff up.
And did they use their numbers and their creed of nonviolence in the street? Did they use it to get to protest and get advances?
Oh, absolutely, Matt. Again and again they came out. The British repressed them with a force and with in a way that they never ever could have in the rest of India for a number of reasons. Number one, this was a remote region of India. The media was almost absent there, so they had a free hand. Number two, the British could not believe that the Pashtuns would ever resort to nonviolence, and they thought this was a ruse, basically, to get their guard down and then to kill all of them.
And so was he imprisoned?
He was imprisoned for 15 years or so under the British, and sad to say, about 15 years or so under the Pakistanis, because after the partition of India into India and Pakistan, he became a Pashtun nationalist. But I must emphasize, in a non-violent way. He never took up arms, never advocated arms, but he wanted a Pashtun homeland, either autonomous or independent. He himself was unclear on that.
Now, you say, Amitabh Pal, that Ghaffar Khan derived his inspiration from Islam itself and from the Quran, and yet here in the United States, certainly, we hear time and time again, especially from right-wingers, that Islam is a religion that is violent at its fundamentals. You take some time to rebut that in your book, Islam Means Peace. Why don't you tell me why that is a stereotype and a false one?
Well, Matt, some of it has to do with a misperception of Islam's history. The West came into conflict with Islam, the Crusades, of course, being the most famous example, in a way that it didn't with any other world religion, such as Hinduism or Buddhism. And that contributed to this image of Islam being spread by the sword, which is a huge misperception, as I point out in my book. Also, the acts of a few and the misinterpretation of the Quran and the Prophet Muhammad's life by a few, you know, which has captured media headlines, especially in the aftermath of September 11th, has led to this idea in the West that Islam is a religion which is violent at the core.
People pick out specific passages from the Quran and say, look, you know, this is a bloody passage, or this is this means that that Muslims are getting their inspiration for their violence from this holy book. You reinterpret some of those passages in your book?
Yes, Matt. As I point out, there are passages encouraging tolerance, encouraging peace, encouraging violence as just as a very last resort in self-defense. Even those aggressive passages that are there in the Quran are most often, if not nearly always, qualified. And they are followed by sort of passages which temper the language of the verse before and urge that if the other side is inclined toward peace, that Muslims should be inclined toward peace too.
And the other concept that people throw around in the United States with a much more narrow meaning and distorted meaning is this whole concept of jihad. And you discuss that in your book, Islam Means Peace. Tell us what the word jihad really means.
Well, jihad actually means struggle. And struggle can be against an external force, which is the way that the reductionist way in which, say, Al-Qaeda and the Taliban have interpreted the word. But also, more importantly, it means struggle, the struggle within. The struggle within against evil, the struggle within oneself against doing evil, doing bad things. And that's the way a majority of Muslims have interpreted jihad. As I show in my book, there was a Gallup poll of 9 countries. Interestingly, among the Arab countries, many of the Arab countries, there was almost no support for jihad as an aggressive aggressive precept. It was only in Indonesia that the majority supported this notion.
Which is surprising, as you say in your book, because Indonesia is not considered to be one of the most militant places as far as recruitment for Al-Qaeda, for instance. What explains the Indonesian result in that poll?
Yes, that indeed is baffling, Matt, and I would have to study Indonesian culture in very much in depth. Interestingly, Indonesia does not even have Islam as its official religion. It's not secular because there are 5 religions which are recognized, but all at the same level.
I learned something about jihad and the Prophet Muhammad, which kind of illustrates the dual meaning of the concept in your book, Islam Means Peace, and that is he was coming off the battlefield and he said, enough of the minor jihad, it's now time for the major jihad. Explain that, what he meant by that.
Yes, so the minor jihad again being the external jihad against enemies of Islam, and the major jihad being the struggle within oneself against evil, against doing bad things. And that's, as I said, is the way that a lot, if not the majority of Muslims around the world, interpret jihad as.
You put a lot of emphasis on the concept of emigration in Islam. As an example of a nonviolent way to resist. Explain that.
Yeah, Hijra. This is the pivotal moment in Islam when the Prophet Muhammad to escape persecution. And I must emphasize that the first 12 or 13 years he was in Mecca, he resisted persecution completely nonviolently. And in the end, after a dozen or so years, the way he fought back against persecution was to emigrate, to leave Mecca non-violently along with his followers and go to Medina. In keeping with that notion, a lot of Muslims, because this is such a hallowed moment in Islam, have followed this notion of hijra or emigration or flight. In fact, those refugees from India who went to Pakistan are still called muhajirs after hijra or emigration because they are emigrants from India, because they were, in their mind at least, escaping religious persecution in India and going over to Pakistan.
You're listening to Progressive Radio. I'm Matt Rothschild. I'm the editor at the Progressive Magazine. My guest today, my colleague Amitabh Pal, author of a great new book, really wise, smart book, called Islam Means Peace, Understanding the Muslim Principle of Nonviolence Today. Pal is spelled like Pal, P-A-L, in case you want to look it up on Google. The odd thing now, Amit, is that here we are 10 years after 9/11, and yet anti-Muslim views in the United States are extremely high, still maybe higher than they were even shortly thereafter. What accounts for that?
It's interesting, Matt. For a while, I had thought that anti-Muslim feeling was decreasing. It seemed, at least in the latter half of the last decade or so, until 2009, that anti-Muslim feelings were on the wane. But the New York City Interfaith Center / mosque controversy reignited these feelings. The Republicans have used anti-Muslim sentiment as a way of getting at Obama. Roughly one-fourth of Americans in a poll a year or two ago believed Obama to be Muslim.
Now, has he responded to that as sufficiently and as profoundly as he should have?
Not at all, Matt. I mean, he has never said that, you know, so what if I'm not Muslim, but so what if I was? There's nothing wrong in being Muslim. In fact, he has taken great pains in distancing himself from Islam. Interestingly, Obama's dad and stepfather were both Muslim, not necessarily very practicing or very devout. So he does, in some sense, come from a Muslim background, although he himself is not Muslim and was raised as a Christian.
And he doesn't, you don't see him, I mean, you see him go to some churches sometimes and probably some synagogues. I don't remember ever seeing him go to a mosque.
No, I don't believe he ever has. In fact, Congressman Keith Ellison of Minnesota offered to sort of, you know, to campaign for him at mosques. He rejected that offer. So he is really, I mean, you know, it's been a long process of distancing himself from Islam in public, although privately he has made some good appointments. He has these sort of, you know, interfaith coordinators. He has tried to reach out to the Muslim world. But in public, he really has kept an arm's length.
And that may just be a pathetic statement, not just on Obama, but on the American people and how, you know, they would react if they saw a picture of Obama at a mosque. I mean, you have in your book statistics such as, you know, 3 out of 10 Americans don't think a Muslim American should be allowed to be president or allowed to be on the U.S. Supreme Court.
Yes, absolutely, Matt. So that is very much him being poll conscious, being conscious of what would not go down well with Americans. In fact, I wrote a column on this. He even refused to go to the holy place of the Sikh religion because he would have to wear a head covering. This is the Golden Temple during his visit to India. And wearing a head covering, he was afraid, he and his team were afraid that he would come across as looking like a Muslim.
So there is that real consciousness on the White House's part about how bigoted the American public is toward Muslims, and yet they're not really hitting it head on, which I believe, and sounds like you believe too, that they ought to be doing. A lot of people in this country have been not exactly confirmed, but they've had their anti-Muslim feelings maybe buttressed by seeing violence around the world. You know, some of that is in response to U.S. foreign policy in supporting policies of the State of Israel, for instance, and you're a student of U.S. foreign policy. There was an interesting aspect in your quote in your book from some scholar who said some of this violence in parts of the Arab or Muslim world is in response to U.S. policies that they consider to be immoral. And also part of it is youthful rage that had no other place to go prior to the Arab Spring anyway. Youthful rage, the guy said, the rage comes first and the theological justification comes second. To what extent do you think U.S. Foreign policy has invited, not excused, but invited some of the violence that we've seen?
Oh, that's been absolutely central. I would point out even Al-Qaeda, as horrible as its global outlook is, has been primarily motivated by its opposition to U.S. policy. You know, among the long list of demands was U.S. troop withdrawal from Saudi Arabia, Israel-Palestine, just, you know, sanctions against Iraq. You know, this is dating back to the mid to late 90s. So whether be it Al-Qaeda or be it the average Arab youth or Arab person, A lot of the opposition to the United States is not because of religion. It's not because of they hate our freedoms type of thing. It's because Israel-Palestine, because of U.S. support of autocratic regimes such as Mubarak in Egypt, Bin Ali in Tunisia, and in a host of other places, and also, of course, because of the U.S. invasion of Iraq now. So, yes, it's primarily motivated by that. And as scholars have pointed out, a lot of the violence against the United States is violence as a response to occupation. It's not violence as a result of Islam.
One of the great things about this book, Islam Means Peace, Amitabh Pal, is that you show the strain of nonviolence in the Middle East. And this, too, came out before the Arab Spring. So you did some studies of it historically, but also in contemporary ways. For instance, you talk about nonviolence in Iran. What is the nonviolent movement like there?
Well, there have actually been two nonviolent movements in Iran. The first one is irredeemably tainted in the eyes of Americans because Khomeini and his clique took over afterward. But the 1979 Iranian Revolution was very broad-based, primarily nonviolent. And as scholars like Professor Stephen Zunis have pointed out, tens of thousands of people were killed nearly completely at the hands of the Shah and his security forces. It was only afterward that Khomeini and his clique took over. And in 2009, 30 years after, as a reaction to this hardline version of Islam that they imposed, had imposed on the country for three decades, the Green Movement sprang up. Ahmadinejad in June, July 2009 stole an election. Almost, it's almost certain that he stole an election, and this movement sprang up. It's still ongoing. I end the book on a negative note, but fortunately, I was being too pessimistic, and this shows how an endless resonance a wonderful idea can have, because the Green Movement was partly an inspiration to the Arab world, and what's happening in the Arab world proved to be in return an inspiration to the Iranians. They've come out in the streets again. Tens of thousands of people protested recently in Iran again.
Let's talk about the Arab Spring. Were you surprised to see it?
A bit surprised, actually, at least at the breadth of it. There hasn't been only, to my knowledge, maybe two countries that have been spared in this entire arc from Morocco on the western edge of the Sahara and North Africa all the way to Iran. Qatar and perhaps United Arab Emirates, even there have been some arrests, are the only two that have been spared large-scale protests. Otherwise, a dozen-plus countries have been convulsed all the way, as I said, from Morocco to Iran, Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, Oman, the list goes on and on and on.
But it hasn't been successful everywhere. It was successful in Tunisia and in Egypt, though the results aren't in finally as to what's going to happen in either of those countries. In Bahrain, there was a ton of repression, both at the hands of the royal family there and at the hands of the royal family in Saudi Arabia that sent in invaders. What do you tell people who say, you know, nonviolence is all well and good, but, you know, ultimately it's not going to get the job done?
I would have two responses, Matt. One is patience. This is what we all need. Let me remind people that in the 80s, mid-80s in Poland, it seemed that solidarity was completely finished. It took a decade for them to come back, and eventually they triumphed. It took three decades plus for Gandhi to triumph in India after he came back from South Africa. It took a decade plus for Martin Luther King to triumph in the United States and get a decade or so civil rights bills passed. We are living in this age of accelerated sort of accelerated motion and attention deficit. And it's been only barely half a year since all this started. I would urge people to have patience. So that's my first response. The second is, it has been shown that nonviolence works. I have cited the study in my book, comprehensive study of nonviolent movements from 1900 to 2006. Nonviolence worked twice as well, 53% of the time, as compared to 26% of the time only in violent insurrections. So let's give it a bit more time, really. It's been just barely 6 months or so since this young man in Tunisia ignited himself, just setting off this amazing movement all throughout the Arab world and in Iran.
I'm speaking with Amitabh Pal. He's my colleague at the Progressive magazine, where he's managing editor. And he's the author of this really great new book called Islam Means Peace, Understanding the Muslim Principle of Nonviolence Today. I'm just wanting to tease you out a little more on this question as to when or whether violence is a moral thing or a necessary thing to do. For instance, you know, what would you say to the ANC in South Africa, Nelson Mandela, who is now revered as a man of peace, but actually the ANC had a military wing and he was head of the ANC? Or what would you say to the, you know, Sandinistas, for instance, or any of these liberation struggles who took up arms to overthrow brutal governments?
That's an interesting question, Matt. I'm not, in spite of all my reverence for nonviolence and pacifism, I must admit I am not an absolutist. In certain extreme cases, perhaps you can justify taking up arms. South Africa was complicated. Interestingly, Mandela reveres Gandhi in spite, and you know, Gandhi's association with South Africa in spite of his own turn toward violence. But I would urge again to take a look at the record and see, you know, that violence basically is nearly always counterproductive in a number of ways. First, the elite circles its wagons. And actually, dissension within the elite is much less when there's an armed insurrection as compared to nonviolence. International support for an armed rebellion is much less. I mean, in a number of ways, an armed uprising actually is destined to be much less successful than a nonviolent, broad-based agitation.
And then what about the impossible Hitler problem?
Well, the Hitler problem is one we all have to grapple with, Matt. But as this esteemed nonviolent scholar Gene Sharp pointed out to me, nonviolence against Hitler did work. In a number of instances, alas, the German people did not take to the streets in the hundreds of thousands and millions, so we don't know what would have happened then. It worked in Berlin, for example. These non-Jewish wives of Jewish men got a number of them released when they demonstrated in Berlin outside Rosenstrasse. In occupied countries, it worked in sabotaging and slowing down the Nazis. So it worked in a number of instances. As I said, we just don't know what would have happened if German people had taken to the streets in larger numbers.
I mean, one place where it has been tried and maybe is being tried more right now is in Palestine. And a lot of times in the West, there hasn't been credit given to Muslims in Palestine who have shunned the idea of taking up arms and actually have tried the nonviolent approach, the nonviolent path. And you identify several people who've been leading the way on that path. Talk about nonviolence in the Palestinian struggle.
Absolutely, Matt. The first intifada or the uprising was primarily nonviolent. It was, that's complicated, that statement is complicated by two things. Number one, there was stone throwing. Now, even among scholars of nonviolence, there is this huge debate about whether stone throwing qualifies as nonviolence, whether it's a violent act, or whether it's liminal, somewhere in the middle. Number two, there was violence not so much against the Israelis, but against Palestinian collaborators. However, as a number of people have pointed out, it was primarily nonviolent. The stone throwing was responded by the Israelis with a huge amount of force. A large number of Palestinians were killed, and yet there wasn't an armed uprising. The second intifada, unfortunately, was much more violent, as we all know, starting in 2000. But even that has had a nonviolent aspect, which has been quite successful. And this is the movement against the Israeli-Palestine separation barrier, which has won victories in places like Budrus, about which an Oscar-nominated documentary has been made, and Bilin, where the Israeli Supreme Court just ordered a while ago and has just been implemented a rerouting of the wall.
And then there was the challenging of the borders, the Israeli borders this spring, and from Syria, Lebanon, and Jordan, which was almost entirely nonviolent and was repressed brutally. I think the Israelis killed 16 people there.
Twice, yes, yes, Matt. That's an added aspect, absolutely. So the international borders were challenged recently twice. Again, there was some stone throwing, etc. But, you know, the repression was completely uncalled for, and the Israelis reacted in a very brutal and typically heavy-handed way.
I'm wondering about press coverage of nonviolent actions in Palestine and other places in the Middle East and around the Arab and Muslim world. Here in the United States, you know, you barely hear or see anything about it. I remember Tom Friedman writing years ago that there should be nonviolence among Palestinians and that they'd get their way and a just state of their own if they'd only use nonviolence. And yet he didn't even wave at the nonviolence that was going on. Or other people in the mainstream corporate media in the United States haven't even touched on this.
Yes, Matt. If we were having this conversation even the end of 2010, I would have completely agreed with you. And there was an almost complete lack of coverage of nonviolent mass movements in the Muslim world, with the partial exception of the Green Movement in Iran. However, now in Egypt and Tunisia, there's been more coverage, which, much to my delight, has complicated, at least to a certain extent, American perception of the Middle East, of the Muslim world. Especially the movement in Egypt, much more than in Tunisia, has caught the American imagination. I think it's something to do perhaps with the pyramids and how big a space Egypt occupies in the American imagination. So that has gotten some coverage and has, as I said, complicated in a good way American perception of the Middle East.
I suppose I should have narrowed my broad statement, and I should be aware of broad statements anyway, to the Palestine-Israel conflict, which the credit for some nonviolent manifestations there doesn't seem to be given.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, you know, as you and I would agree, coverage of Israel is extremely problematic in this country. It's very one-sided most often. And so, in my view, anything that contributes to a positive perception of the Palestinian struggle is something that's downplayed or almost completely ignored. And that was the case with the First Intifada, which received positive coverage, I can tell you, in much of the rest of the world, and the nonviolent movement in against the separation barrier, which in spite of the participation of Jimmy Carter, Desmond Tutu, Gandhi's grandson Rajmohan Gandhi has gone there and participated in the demonstrations. All of this has been almost completely ignored in the U.S. media.
We only have about a minute and a half left, Amit Paul. In the conclusion, you write, to ask that people appreciate the complexities of Islam is perhaps too much. But you're being too generous there because, of course, you want people to appreciate the complexities of Islam. And that's one of the reasons you wrote the book, I understand. The question is, how do we get people in the United States to appreciate these complexities?
I'm so glad you brought that up, Matt, because my aim in this book is not to whitewash Islam. Of course, Islam, like any other religion, has had its share of violence. For those who think Buddhism hasn't, I would urge that they look at Sri Lanka and Burma. But to complicate their notions of Islam, and to do this, you know, perhaps by reading my book, by reading other progressive Muslim scholars on Islam, there are a number of them. John Esposito, there is Omid Safi. Just pick up their stuff, you know, go beyond the mainstream media and try to get a better understanding of Islam.
Well, unfortunately, we're going to have to leave it there, but I would recommend that people would pick up your book, Islam Means Peace, Understanding the Muslim Principle of Nonviolence Today by Amitabh Pal. Amit, thanks so much for being my guest today.
Thank you so much, Matt.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by Mufa. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.